Hello, and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are hundreds more of these conversations that you can get free of charge and with no ads because we're the ABC. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or just go to iTunes and search for Conversations with Richard Feidler. And while you're there, you can subscribe to this program if you like and have a conversation delivered to you every weekday automatically. It's easy.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Way back in 1951, a young African-American woman called Henrietta Lacks went to see the doctors at Johns Hopkins Hospital in the city of Baltimore. She said that there was something inside her that felt like a kind of a knot. What came from that visit is simply one of the most extraordinary stories I've ever heard. Your life has almost been certainly affected by what happened on that day in one way or another. And when I heard this story, I wondered why I'd never heard of Henrietta Lacks before, or HeLa, as she's known to scientists, the first human being that we know of to seriously touch immortality. This story shows how science can transform the lives of millions of people for the better, but it also reveals how clumsy and heartless it can be in dealing with individual human beings. Rebecca Skloot is here to tell that story. Rebecca is a science writer who's contributed articles to the New York Times magazine and to several scientific journals in the United States. Rebecca Skloot's book is called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's deeply moving, gripping, and an act of kindness too. Rebecca, welcome to Conversations.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, I first heard this story about a week ago, listening to an old episode on a podcast of Radiolab, a show you contribute to sometimes. And when I heard it, I got excited. I went home, told my wife about this, made her listen to it, came into the office, told everyone in the office about it, and looked across the vast pile of books that are right next to my desk, and there was your book. Now, that was a kind of a coincidence, but Henrietta's family wouldn't see that as any kind of coincidence, would they?
No, not at all. And at this point, probably neither would I. But yes, that was obviously Henrietta had placed that book there and made it so that you heard the Radiolab story to pique your interest.
Well, her family were telling you that all the time, weren't they, when you found things?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when, Henrietta died in the 50s, she left five children behind, and they didn't know anything about these cells having grown until about 25 years later. And, you know, her husband had a third grade education. He didn't even know what a cell was. And he got this phone call one day saying what he thought to be, we've got your wife. She's alive in the laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years. And now we have to test your children to see if they have cancer. None of which was what they said at all. But, you know, they didn't know what a cell was. He thought they had her in a prison cell. That was the only kind of cell he'd ever heard of. And so the family very much believed that her soul was alive in these cells. They would often ask scientists, you know, what does it mean that these cells are alive all these years after she died? And can she rest in peace if you're, you know, shooting these bits of her up to the moon and injecting them with chemicals? So they've always believed that Henrietta and the cells are one, and that these cells are essentially an extension of her living on, and that she actually does control things, including me. It took me about a year and a half to convince them to talk to me and sort of win their trust. But eventually they believed that I had been sort of chosen to tell this story, and that Henrietta had sort of been working me as a puppet my whole life. You know, go over here and study science, go over here and study writing, and also that I could write this book eventually.
Rebecca, I think it's interesting you sort of said that you're not quite sure if you think that's true or not at this point, but I want to come to that a little bit later. The story sort of, you can start at any point really, but let's start at that doctor's visit in 1951 when she came to the doctor feeling unwell, talking about a knot. They obviously found a tumor. How did the examining doctor describe this tumor?
It was about the size of a nickel, and it was very unusual looking. It was purple and raised and sort of glistening. He described it as looking like grape jello. And to this day, I mean, he remembers that tumor very clearly because he just never saw anything like it in his whole career.
She had cervical cancer, and then parts of that carcinoma were removed for research purposes. Why were they taken away for research purposes? What was going on, Rebecca?
Well, Henrietta went into the hospital at, it happened to be at this incredibly important time in the history of cervical cancer research. The pap smear had just recently been developed, and the doctors at Johns Hopkins were taking samples from any woman who came in with cervical cancer with hopes of growing those samples in a petri dish so that they could look at the cells under a microscope and see what they actually looked like. Because they had the pap smear, but they didn't really know how to use it. So they were basically trying to identify what they were looking for with the pap smear. And at the same time, George Guy, who is the scientist who actually grew the cells, he had been trying to just grow any cells outside the body. There was this effort worldwide going on to grow human cells so that they could be used in the laboratory in place of animals for research and in place to do some studies that you couldn't really do on living humans. So there were a lot of reasons why her cells were grown or were taken. And George Guy had been trying for decades to grow human cells, and they just always died.
Always. It always failed.
Right, and hers just didn't.
What happened when her cells were brought to the lab? You spoke to the research assistant. How did she describe her own kind of blasé reaction to another bunch of cells?
Yeah, she was actually eating her lunch when the cells came in, and you know, she has this very clear memory of sitting there, and George Guy came in with, you know, yet another dish of cells for her to cut. You know, so she would take the tumor and cut it into little bits and try it, put it in different test tubes and try and grow it. And she just sort of rolled her eyes and she was like, oh, great, another batch of cells that are all going to die. You know, I'm just going to finish my lunch. And, you know, every moment that you didn't, you know, that the cells sat there on the counter was, you know, they got closer to death. So, you know, for her to actually even put off doing something with the cells made it more likely that they would have died.
What did she notice about these cells?
Well, initially nothing. They just looked like every other cells, and she put them in the dishes, and then she went home for the day. And then when she came back into the lab, there was this little white ring around the bits of tissue in each of the dishes, and it looked like, she's described it as looking like fried egg yolk. And then almost immediately the cells just took off. They doubled their numbers every 24 hours. So they very quickly filled each tube that they were in. And then they divided those into two and then four and then eight and then 16. And I mean, they just took over the lab pretty quickly. And they did the same thing in Henrietta's body. I mean, her cancer, there was something about her cancer that was incredibly powerful. And that nickel-sized tumor within just a few months took over almost every organ in her body.
Now extraordinarily,
she died pretty quickly.
Yeah, she'd actually given birth 3 months before this diagnosis.
Right.
They hadn't noticed the tumor then?
No, they hadn't. And whether that's just because they didn't notice it or because it wasn't there, no one will ever know. There's a chance. I mean, given how fast the cancer grew and spread, there's absolutely a chance that it wasn't there 3 months earlier and that it appeared that quickly. There's also a chance that they just didn't see it when she was giving birth.
Now,
so nobody really knows that.
This is the I suppose, in some ways, the strangest part of the story. Are you saying then that her cells, these cancer cells, were effectively immortal?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's immortality. There's actually a scientific term, immortality, when it applies to cells. So an immortal cell line, the definition of that is a line of cells that all descended from one sample that will just never die. They will continue to grow and divide, and there will always be cells that descended from that first sample. And that's the case with hers, absolutely.
And her cells...
I mean, you can kill them, but... If you feed them and keep them warm, they'll stay alive forever.
So these cells, these cancer cells, then are filling test tube after test tube. How shocked were the scientists by this?
Well, initially, George Guy actually didn't believe that they were immortal, in part, I think, because he just didn't want to get his hopes up because he'd been trying to do this for so many decades. But then when it became clear that these were actually not going to die, He was ecstatic. They all were. And George Guy began telling friends of his in other labs, you know, I think I have the first immortal human cell line. And they all said, great, can we have some? And so he just sent them to anybody who would use them in research. He would, you know, today you can go online and you order a vial of cells and they'll FedEx them to you. And, you know, it's a very quick process. But then you couldn't just send cells by mail. So he would actually take tubes of cells to the airport and go to pilots and flight attendants and say, you know, hey, will you stick this in your pocket and take it to, you know, Minneapolis or India or wherever it needed to go? And they would do that to keep the cells warm, and they would fly wherever they needed to go. And then on the other end, there'd be a scientist standing there waiting for the cells, and they'd grab the tubes and run back to their offices and grow them. And the excitement around this was just incredible. The number of scientists around the world who'd been waiting for something like this for years was pretty amazing.
The cells were called HeLa, short for, of course, Henrietta Lacks, but that doesn't really point to her identity specifically. And as you say, she died at this point from the cancer. What did they performed an autopsy on her. What did the autopsy reveal about that cancer?
Yeah, the autopsy revealed that the cancer had spread to almost every organ in her body. You know, she was 30 years old, and George Guy's assistant, Mary, who was there in the room, described it as looking as if someone had poured a bucket of pearls inside of her, that she was just filled with these white tumors.
Before she died, did she have any knowledge that her cancer cells were being used for research purposes?
No, not at all. She was under anesthesia when they took the cells, so she didn't know that they had taken them in the first place. There's a bit of a debate about whether George Guy ever said anything to her. Everyone that I talked to who knew him and who was around at the time said he never had any contact with her, and you know, he didn't even know anything about her. But one woman who worked in his lab with him said, oh yeah, he told me that not long before she died, he went to her bedside and said, your cells will make you immortal. They will live on and help millions of people. And that Henrietta said that she was, that was good, that she was happy to hear that. Whether that's true, I was never able to verify it beyond that one person.
Doesn't ring true. Sounds like a scene from a movie, doesn't it, Rebecca?
It sounds a little good, too good to be true, but it also, even if it had happened, I mean, it doesn't really match up to what I know about George Guy's personality, really. I mean, he was a very down-to-earth sort of fact-driven guy. I don't think he would have made that kind of a proclamation at that point. But also that even if he had, she wouldn't have understood it. She was on so many different, you know, heavy-duty morphine and all sorts of other pain drugs. She wouldn't have understood what he said, even if she had known what a cell was and what immortality was. I mean, it was just, it would have been beyond her even if he did say something.
My guest in conversation is Rebecca Skloot. She's the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, one of the great science stories and human stories, if you like, of the last century, a story that's very much with us today. Now, as you said, this was a really timely moment for scientists to discover immortal cells, the HeLa cells, as they were called, because there was a polio epidemic happening through the United States and indeed through the world at that time. There was a march for polio cure in New York City at that time, Rebecca.
Yeah, and the year she died was the deadliest in the history of the polio epidemic. And it was just getting progressively worse every year. More and more people were dying. And Jonas Salk had just created the vaccine for polio, but he couldn't use it because it hadn't been tested. It hadn't been proven effective or safe. And at the time, one of the only ways that they could test to prove a vaccine was effective was to use cells that they could infect with polio. And they were using monkey cells at the time. But because they couldn't grow them indefinitely in culture, they would have to actually harvest these cells from monkeys fresh every time they needed to use them. And the volume of cells that they would have needed to prove that the polio vaccine was effective would have cost, you know, millions and millions of monkeys' lives. And what they were more concerned about was millions and millions of dollars. It was just sort of an inconceivable task. So they were on this quest to find some way to have cells growing that wouldn't involve having to basically kill monkeys every time they needed them. And Henrietta's cells just appeared at that moment when they needed them the most.
How did they bring them into mass production?
They set up a factory, a cell factory. And as soon as the March of Dimes realized that her cells would, in fact, work for the testing the polio vaccine, they set up this factory at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, and they had these enormous steel vats of culture medium, which is the liquid that you grow them in, and big assembly lines of test tube vials and about seven technicians who worked the lab, all of them black. This was an all-black university. And they just did this an assembly line production, and they grew the cells to the tune of about 6 trillion cells a week and sent those out to laboratories around the world. So the volume of cells that they grew was pretty incredible.
6 trillion cells?
A week.
A week.
Yeah.
Did that mean that then meant that the polio vaccine could be quickly created and then quickly disseminated? And bang, that's the end of polio, Rebecca.
Right. It was, and the polio vaccine was being created in other ways. It was really the testing that was done with those cells. And all of those, yeah, the 6 trillion cells every week were going out to these polio testing centers. And the field trials for testing polio vaccine were the biggest in history. Millions of, you know, kids got these vaccines. And so they did that. But then at the same time, they were able to grow so many cells that they were also sending them out for lots of other research. And the explosion of science that happened in 1954 to 56 using her cells was very challenging, in a sense, to document in the book, because it was like there was no science for a long time using cells. And then all of a sudden it was like, you know, this unbelievable explosion of discoveries related to cells, all using her cells, you know, the first cells ever cloned effort.
You write in your book that that HeLa cells were used to learn they were used for the study of herpes, for leukemia, Parkinson's disease, HIV/AIDS. They were even sent into space. Why were HeLa cells sent into space, Rebecca?
The HeLa cells in space is one of my favorite of the research stories, in part because I love just that phrase, you know, HeLa in space.
HeLa in space.
Exactly. But they also, what's interesting is this was the very beginning of the space missions. So the idea was, if you could send these human cells up in space, you could see what happened to them in zero gravity. So, and one of the things that they found was that every time they sent HeLa cells up, they grew faster. And so they thought, well, you know, wow, if an astronaut has cancer, every time we send this person up, is his cancer going to grow faster and faster and faster and become this sort of mutant cancer? But what I think is most interesting is that the whole thing was actually a cover for a spying mission. So they went up in these satellites that were actually going up to photograph Russia. And they called this a biological payload. So the HeLa cell research was legitimate research, but it was actually just covering up spying.
One of the most fascinating episodes in your book is when you show how this cell research exploded, as you say, after this, and scientists suddenly discover that, wow, normal human cells eventually, if you have them in cell culture, they turn into cancer cells. Wrong. 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 What had happened there?
They called this the HeLa bomb. Because in the early days, right after HeLa cells grew, the scientists started taking samples from anyone they could get their hands on, themselves, their kids, their patients, trying to grow a library of human tissues from different sources. You know, they thought if we could grow, you know, breast cells and prostate cells and brain cells, and then we can use them to study all these different organs and different diseases. And they used the same techniques that George Guy used to grow HeLa, and growing cells was just sort of miraculously easy suddenly. And their cells would grow, and then often within, you know, a few weeks or so, they would suddenly become cancerous and take off and grow similarly to HeLa cells. And scientists thought that they had identified the moment that cancer happens. And
my God, the cure for cancer. I know, it's right within our grasp now, the cure for cancer. That's what they
exactly
thought.
And yes, what actually had happened was that HeLa cells had just contaminated all of the other cell lines. So it turns out that, you know, cells can float on dust particles in the air. If you touch a dish of HeLa cells with your hands and then go touch another dish, you can transfer them from one to the other. And HeLa cells grow so much more powerfully.
Can we just back up a second?
Sure.
HeLa cells were going from one cell culture in a lab, getting a lift on a dust mote.
Someone's sleeves
and going on a magic carpet ride, upstairs, mm-hmm. round down a corridor, round in through the door, landing on someone else's petri dish and saying, we're moving in, you're all going to have to move out. That's what the HeLa cells were doing?
Yes, that's exactly what HeLa cells were doing. And in some cases, it was a more direct transfer. They would use pipettes to, you know, these devices that suck cells out of a dish, and then they would go reuse those in another dish, and they would just be filled with HeLa cells, and they didn't realize it. And one scientist, actually, to prove the fact that they were doing this, he he had a vial of HeLa cells, and he put it, you know, on one side of the room, and then on the other side of the room, he had a bunch of empty culture dishes. And he just stirred that vial on the one side of the room and then left and never touched the other dishes, and then came back and, you know, they were, HeLa cells were growing in these other dishes. So, yeah, so they could travel around, basically. And so millions of dollars in research was being poured into cell culture. You know, Nixon launched his war on cancer, which was this multi-million dollar effort where they were going to find the cure. And then suddenly, in the late 60s, this one young scientist realized what had happened. He was doing some early genetic tests and looking at gene markers in cells, and he was looking at a prostate cancer cell from a white guy, and he noticed that the prostate cancer cell had two X chromosomes, which isn't possible because women have two X chromosomes and men have an X and a Y, so you can't have a prostate cancer cells. So he then started looking at other markers, and he saw that this cell had this very rare enzyme marker that's really only found in black people, and this was supposed to be from a white guy. So he thought, well, that's weird. This white guy's prostate seems to be from a black woman. And then he started looking at all the other samples that he could get his hands on, and they all had those same two markers. So he realized pretty quickly what had happened, and he just stood up at a conference one day and said, you know all those cells we've been working with? Those are actually all HeLa. And it was a huge controversy. I mean, millions of dollars.
Your research is now worthless. And how did that go over with the scientists, Rebecca?
Not very well. one of my favorite quotes in the book is a scientist described it as this guy coming along and dropping a turd in the punch bowl. You know, it had been this enormous, you know, cell culture was going to save the world, and it was this, and then suddenly they just went, oh. So a lot of people denied that it had happened at all, saying, you know, that would be sloppy technique. I would never do such a thing. And so this is actually what led to the family finding out finally that Henrietta's cells were still alive, because this was the early days of gene mapping. One scientist figured out, well, if we can get a hold of her kids and get some samples from her kids, we can treat this like a crime scene and use DNA from her kids to, you know, essentially compare them to all these cells. And if they are, in fact, HeLa, they'll match her kids. And that's when they got that sort of fated phone call 25 years after her death, which they thought was saying that she was alive and that they were being tested to see if they were going to die, which wasn't, in fact, what they said at all.
Rebecca Skloot is here in conversation with me. She's the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, a woman whose tumour cells were unusually vigorous. Do you have a figure, Rebecca, on how many of her cells were grown?
Yeah, there have been several efforts to figure that out. One scientist calculated that if you could have saved all of the cells that grew from that first sample and put them on a scale, that by now they would weigh more than 50 million metric tons, you know, which is more than 150 Empire State Buildings. And cells weigh almost nothing on their own, so it's hard to even wrap your mind around how many cells that actually is.
How many Empire State Buildings did you say?
150. More than 150. So
around about the time of this phone call to the family you mentioned there, scientists began to ask a really important and obvious question. Who was Henrietta Lacks? What can you tell me about Henrietta Lacks, the kind of person she was and where she grew up?
Well, she was a tobacco farmer, so she grew up farming the same land that her ancestors had worked as slaves. And she lived in an old slave shack that is still barely standing today, but, you know, it was just a log cabin. And, you know, she had her children on the dirt floor there, and she had her first child at 14 with her cousin who had been raised with him as a sort of sibling. They shared a bedroom their whole lives. She and her husband moved up to Baltimore in the 40s because they couldn't make a living on their farm. And there was this migration from the South of a lot of black farmers who went to the steel mills when war broke out and there was this great demand for steel. So they had moved north, you know, sort of the promised land. And she was this incredibly caring woman. A lot of her cousins and relatives and various people from the South would come up to Baltimore after her. And basically, if you came to town and you needed a place to stay while you got settled and, you know, made some money before you could afford your own place, you just stayed on her floor. So at any given time, there could be up to a dozen cousins just sort of camped out on the floor. I talked to one guy who had his own mattress in the hall right outside her bathroom for almost a year. You know, and if you were hungry and you didn't have any food, you went to her house because she always had something on the stove cooking. And if you needed a girlfriend, she'd find you one. I mean, she just took care of everybody. And for her family, you know, eventually they kind of came to feel like this was part of the cells being an extension of her, that the cells are taking care of everyone too, and that they have her personality in that way, and that that's their usefulness in science is part of her desire to help people.
It's I suppose there is the temptation to project the qualities of these cells back onto Henrietta, but it's hard to avoid that conclusion, Rebecca.
Yeah.
The way you're describing her, you know, growing up in these old slave quarters in Virginia and having five kids before, you know, before she died at the age of 30. I'm looking at a photo of her on the cover of your book, and she's beautiful and really sharply dressed, and she's obviously taken great care about her appearance.
Yeah, she did, which was something that everyone who knew her commented on when I talked to them about her. She, you know, she didn't have any money, but and she had, you know, one nice dress suit. She had two silk slips, and she washed those things by hand every night and hung them up so she could wear them. She meticulously painted her fingernails and her toenails and did her hair. She paid a lot of attention to her appearance, and she was beautiful. So she wasn't a woman who looked like she was in the kind of need that she actually was in, and I think that was actually important to her. And it's interesting that the toenail polish is something that comes up again and again in her story. And there's this moment during the autopsy where the laboratory assistant who grew the cells is down there collecting more samples, and she catches a glance of Henrietta's toenails, and they're all chipped, but you can see the red polish still on them. And that was the first moment that this woman ever thought about the fact that the cells actually came from a human being. She said, "I looked down at those toenails and I thought, oh no, you know, she actually painted those toes in her bathroom somewhere probably." And that was the first moment that the cells were sort of humanized for her at all. And that comes back again and again through her story.
Rebecca Skloot is here in conversation with me. Her book is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, the story of Henrietta and her family and her children, and how the knowledge of what was happening to her cells long after Henrietta had died, the shattering effect that had on the family.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today you're hearing the story of the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. It's the title of a book written by my guest, who is Rebecca Skloot. Rebecca is a science writer. This book she's written is simply one of the great stories of the 20th century in science, in scientific terms, and in human terms as well. It's the story of Henrietta Lacks, who went to be treated for a tumour. Bits of the tumour were taken, and it was found that her cells were in fact immortal. But not much thought was actually given to the woman who died shortly after having given those cells without her actual knowledge. When did you first hear about HeLa, Rebecca?
I first learned about the cells when I was 16 in a basic biology class. My teacher said what most biology teachers say at some point in a biology lesson, which is, there are these incredible cells. They've been alive since 1951, even though the woman they came from has died that same year. They were one of the most important things that happened to medicine. And he sort of listed off a few of the things that the cells did. And then what was unusual is that he knew her name. So he wrote Henrietta Lacks in big letters on the board and then turned around and said, she was a black woman. And then that was it. And class was over. And I went up to him after class and I said, well, what else do we know about her? Who was she? And, you know, why these cells? And what did her family think of this? And he just said, sorry, we don't know anything. And it just stuck. And I just became obsessed with them at that point and really never let it go. I studied the cells before I tried to find anything out about much about her. And then I started just trying to, my actual first research of trying to actually find her family is just like, you know, phone books and going online and looking for them. And it became clear very quickly that they didn't want to be found. I mean, they were very well hidden. And eventually I found a scientist who had created this conference, a yearly conference in Henrietta's name. And he, it turned out, had contact with the family. And I asked him to put me in touch with them. And he proceeded to grill me for about 4-5 days straight over the phone about basically my intentions and whether he should put me in touch with them. And eventually he deemed me worthy and did give me Deborah's phone number.
He did grill you, as you say, and he asked you what you knew about African Americans and medical research, the history of that in the United States. It turns out you did know something about that, and this is kind of important to the story.
Yeah, absolutely. He was African American, and he was one of George Guy's only African American students, and that's how he sort of was involved with the story. And, you know, yeah, one of the first questions he asked me, I mean, after saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are white, aren't you? He just said that my race was going to be a big hurdle, and he wanted to know, like, what I knew about all, what African Americans had been through with science. And, you know, there's a long history of African Americans being used in research without their consent. You know, the Tuskegee syphilis studies is one of the most well-known cases, where hundreds of black men were essentially studied to watch how syphilis killed you from infection to death without being offered treatment when it was available.
What did that gynecologist, Roland Petillo, advise you in dealing with the lax family, the children of Henrietta Lacks?
He said, be honest. Don't hide anything from them. Don't be pushy. And he said, more than anything, you're going to have to be patient. You're going to need patience more than you can imagine. And he was right. My first phone call with Deborah was this incredible sort of manic 45-minute-long conversation where she answered the phone and I said I was interested in writing a book about her mother, and she just started talking in this stream of consciousness, mentioning little things here and there that I didn't really understand. You know, somebody killed somebody and somebody stole her mother's medical records, and there were the snippets of their story. And then all of a sudden she panicked, and she said she worried that Johns Hopkins had maybe sent me to steal her cells, and she didn't know who to trust. And then she hung up on me. I just sort of went, wow. And that was the moment I realized there was something much more to the story than just the story of Henrietta and her cells.
So this is when you kind of went on the detective trial. What happened to Deborah and her brothers after their mother, brothers and sisters, I should say, after their mother, Henrietta, had died?
Well, immediately after she died, long before they knew anything about the cells, they were left with their father, who worked full-time, two different jobs, trying to support the kids. And there was this stream of cousins who would come in and take care of the kids, and some of them were incredibly abusive to the children, you know, to the point of, you know, tying one of them, the youngest son, was left tied up in the basement for long periods of time, whipped, and Deborah was molested by one of them. And their lives after Henrietta's death were horrible, and always colored by the fact that if Henrietta had just been alive, she wouldn't have let any of this happen. So 25 years later, when they got this phone call saying her cells were alive, it was sort of a dream come true. But at the same time, it was sort of terrifying. And they wanted to know, well, was this research hurting her in some way in the afterlife? And that started a long sort of saga for the family, particularly Deborah, who was the most really damaged by the loss of her mother and then the discovery of these cells.
Once they discovered that there were these cells being mass-produced, did they, in their language, see those cells, the HeLa cells, as her, containing her soul, if you like?
Oh, absolutely. And this is one of the points in the story where scientists and the Lacks family really diverge. You know, scientists will say, well, but what? They're just some of her cells. She can't feel this. But for the family, her DNA is in there, and it is a part of her. And not only that, it's a part of her womb. It's the part of the same place in her body where they came from. And yeah, they absolutely believed that her soul was alive in there, and that she had essentially been brought back to life as an angel to take care of people.
To a small degree, do you think they might be right in a sense that it is a part of her that's still alive while the rest of her is dead and thriving and propagating, and it contains all the genetic information of Henrietta? In some ways, it kind of is her. It's not guided by a mind, but it is her to some degree, isn't it, Rebecca?
Yeah, it's hard to argue against that. And a lot of that depends on how you define life and how you define a soul and how you define a self. And that's one of the points in the story where it gets very spiritual for some people. Scientists tend to go with the harder fact, you know, line of thinking. Well, you know, we know that there is no thinking in there. There's no neurons. There's no nerves. She can't feel things. But yeah, absolutely. It very much depends on how you define those things. And, you know, her DNA is in there. You can look at her DNA, even though it's sort of mutated after all these years of growing in culture. You know, you can learn things about her and her kids. And there's not, you know, the only other example of a little bit of you that can live on like that with your DNA in it after your death is your children, basically. And especially if you don't know what a cell is, if you don't have any background in science, it's very hard to wrap your mind around what that means, that this part of her is still alive.
This is when we get to the point where research scientists and I suppose journalists to some degree can be kind of emotionally tone deaf, Rebecca, when they're in the pursuit of the greater good, saving millions of lives. And here's a shocking case of this. You write in your book that when they realised that so many cell cultures have been contaminated, if that's the word, or mastered by Henrietta's cells, the HeLa cells, they needed to get DNA samples from the surviving children. They sent a research scientist who was a Chinese-American woman with a slightly, you know, imperfect but a slightly broken grasp of English. How did that conversation go with the Lax family?
Yes, well, yes, to say that it was slightly difficult was, yes, is a kind way to put it. She was Chinese. She had only been in the United States for a very short while. She was a graduate student who'd come to study at Hopkins, and the scientist whose lab she worked in, very famous geneticist, often held up as, you know, the grandfather of the Human Genome Project. He did incredibly important genetic research. He said, you know, go get some samples from this family. He didn't tell her how to explain these cells' existence, or even that the family didn't know. And so she called, and in English that was very hard for me to understand 25 years later when I talked to her, said that the cells were alive and that she needed samples from them. And you know, she said, we need to look at your HLA markers to see if there's, you know, the antigens or the matching with the HeLa, and you know, things that they just could not have understood, even if she had been speaking perfect English. So it really was a sort of, there was a communication breakdown. It was a sort of clash of cultures. She couldn't understand them either. I mean, Henrietta's husband speaks with a very thick Southern accent. His children often teased him and called it his country mumble. He just sort of talked like this. Yeah, so she couldn't have understood him. He couldn't understand her. And no one stopped to say, wait a minute, we should make sure everyone actually knows what's going on here.
They didn't even know what a cell was. And you say they thought that in the DNA test they were actually being tested for cancer, and they spent months waiting for results.
Yeah, this was one of the first very traumatic things that happened, particularly for Deborah. You know, she grew up knowing that her mother died at 30. She didn't really know why, and she had lived her life in fear of her own 30th birthday, thinking that the same would happen to her. She was in her late 20s when the doctors called, so for her and for her the rest of her family, it seemed like the appropriate timing, and she thought, oh, my worst fears are coming true. You know, they're coming now when I'm about my mother's age to test me to see if I'm going to die like she did. So they took the samples from the kids and then went away, and the family just waited for their results, which never came, and they would occasionally call the switchboard at Hopkins and say, you know, we're calling for our test results, and the operator would just say, I'm sorry, I don't have any record of you as a patient. I don't know what tests you're talking about. And then periodically the scientists would come back and take more samples, and the family thought all along that it was them that was being tested.
There's a Dr. McCusick who was sort of in charge of this process of checking the DNA of the family, and they were brought into the presence of this great man, the family, and Dr. McCusick told Deborah about her mother's cells being blown up by atomic bombs, which they were, to test the effect of radiation on human cells, and going up on space missions. What did Deborah hear when Dr. McCusick told her this?
Yeah, this was another moment of sort of communication misfire. He thought she wanted to know about the cells, so he told her about this research. And to her, all she heard was, they're blowing up my mother. They're sending my mother to the moon. Over and over again, you know, later they created the first cells that were essentially a fusion of mouse cells and human cells, these hybrids, mouse-human hybrids, and they made those with HeLa cells. And when Deborah heard about that, you know, all she heard was, they created something that's half my mother and half mouse. They did the same thing with a tobacco plant, you know. And so for her, these were just all terrifying. And she really worried that it was somehow causing damage to her mother. When she found out that the cells were cloned, she very much believed her mother had been cloned. And so she was terrified of going to any major city in the United States to, you know, up until when I met her, and I was never able to really convince her that this wasn't the case. She wouldn't go to any city because she thought that if she got off of, you know, a train or a plane, she would see her mother everywhere, these clones of her mother walking down the street, and that her mother wouldn't know that she was her daughter, and that it would be this very terrifying experience. And, you know, I would explain to her, no, it's the cells that have been cloned, not her. And she would just sort of say, yeah, right. You know, I've seen the movies. You know, if you Google Henrietta Lacks and clone, you get thousands and thousands of hits. So she thought, well, there's thousands and thousands of clones.
The Lacks family are from the Bible Belt, and they're deeply Christian people. Of course, their education, they had no education to speak of beyond, not even beyond, really up to high school, did they? So they didn't really know anything about cells or the science, but they did know something about voodoo. To some extent, did they see this as witchcraft?
Some members of her family definitely did. There was one of her cousins who very much believed that he told me, you know, there some diseases are man-made and some diseases are like God-made or spirit-made. And, you know, he very much believed that this was an act of voodoo that had created this cancer. And he's, you know, he would say, how else do you explain how these cells are growing like this all these years after she died? That's something that the family struggled with on many levels. He was the only one who had that really deep sort of voodoo belief, but there were different levels of that throughout the family, and a lot of them felt like the cells are a miracle, that that they really are essentially Henrietta reincarnated. You know, if you read the Bible, it says very clearly, believers will be granted immortal life, and you never know what form they're going to come back in. So for a lot of members of her family, you know, you look at the cells and you say, okay, so this is the form that she came back in, and because she was such a good Christian woman, she was essentially chosen as the first immortal being. You know, and when you look at what the cells can do, you know, they can cure diseases, they can cause problems. If you know, the way they see it is the contamination problem was Henrietta getting back at scientists for hiding things from her family. So, you know, like she has the power to, you know, cause problems if you make her mad. She'll cure diseases. So for them, that spiritual realm was a lot of how they understood the cells in the end.
My guest in conversation is Rebecca Skluch. She's the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's the story of a woman who died in 1951, an African-American woman in Baltimore. Her cells were used for scientific research. The cancer cells turned out to be immortal and were responsible for countless medical breakthroughs as a result, and today her cells are still being used in scientific research. Her daughter Deborah had a breakdown when she discovered that she had a sister she never really knew about, called Elsie. What's that story, Rebecca?
Yeah, the story of Elsie is in some ways one of the most surprising and disturbing stories, I think, in the book. So Elsie was Deborah's older sister and the only other daughter in the family. And she was born epileptic and deaf. And she was institutionalized around the time that Henrietta got sick because there were five children at that point. Henrietta had a very hard time taking care of Elsie. So she was institutionalized at the recommendation of Henrietta's doctors. And the institution they put her in turned out to, you know, it had recently been called the Home for Crazy Negroes.
Home for Crazy Negroes?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, being black in the South in the 50s was a very unpleasant thing. Being, you know, a black child in an institution for black mentally ill patients in the 50s was something that is just sort of unthinkable. I mean, most of the patients there were not actually mentally ill. It was sort of an umbrella term that they would put over anyone who had epilepsy, if you were deaf, if you had syphilis. There were, you know, adults housed with children, men with women. So there was a lot of, you know, molesting going on.
And I also understand, Rebecca, that some African-Americans were imprisoned for being civil rights protesters, because the feeling was that if you, there was the protest psychosis, as it was called,
right.
If you protested, then you had to be deranged.
Right. And this particular hospital turned out to be one of the worst. And it was the same year Elsie died there when she was 15. And that same year, the hospital, there was this big investigative story that ran in the newspaper in Baltimore about how overcrowded the hospital was, and that there were, you know, basically patients went in and then they just never came out. They died in there, and that they were all, you know, curable patients. Most of them weren't even sick, and that they were just pretty horrendous things going on in the hospital. And so Deborah didn't know any of that, but she just had this feeling. So she didn't know she had a sister until pretty late in life. And she just, with both her mother and her sister, and I think some of this came from the fact that Deborah was the only girl in her, she was raised around a lot of men who, a lot of them abused her. And she had this feeling of, you know, if my mother and my sister had been here, they would have protected me. That's what women do for each other. And so when she found out about her sister and then also about her mother's cells, she really felt like she needed to protect them. She needed to find out what happened to them. So when I came along and, you know, wanting to write this book, one of the things, once Deborah finally agreed to talk to me, you know, I said, you can come with me. We'll go into laboratories. You can see your mother's cells for the first time, which we did. And she said, you know, you have to promise me two things. If I talk to you, you're never going to hide anything from me, and you're going to figure out what happened to my mother and my sister, and you're going to tell me. So we would travel together. She would sometimes come with me when I did my research, and we went to the institution where her sister died. And what we found there was beyond anything either of us could have really imagined. There were, you know, these. We found a photograph of her, just absolutely sort of battered, with a pair of white hands wrapped around her neck. And you know, we found a lot of these newspaper articles about the hospital at the time. And as we were finding this information, you know, Deborah was sitting next to me. I wasn't in a position where I could have filtered any of this for her or said, you know, are you sure you want to know this? We knew going in that she could find out some traumatic stuff, but we didn't really have any sense of what we were going to find. And she, the combination of the excitement of seeing her mother's cells for the first time, which we did the day before we went to this hospital, and she actually got to, you know, look at the cells under the microscope and hold them in her hand. And for her, that was the closest she'd ever come to meeting her mother. So there was a lot of emotions tied up in that. And then, you know, the very next day, going to this hospital where we found this information about her sister, she had an absolute breakdown to the point where, I mean, it was actually life-threatening. I mean, she really, you know, her blood pressure shot up, and it was a pivotal moment for me as a writer in a lot of ways, because I realized, you know, that I had essentially become a character in the story, that I had been another person who came along and you know, put her in this position where suddenly her life was in danger. And in a lot of ways, that's why I'm actually in the book as a character, so you could see this story as it unfolded.
Then you witnessed her undergo something that really can only be described as a kind of exorcism.
Yeah. Yeah, we were in Henrietta's sister's house, which is a slave shack in the same place in Virginia where Henrietta grew up. And Deborah was having this breakdown, and her cousin was this very deeply religious man who, you know, he was one of these people who would just sort of channel the Lord in the middle of a conversation. And he was watching Deborah just sort of spiral, and he just stood up and without warning, he just grabbed her head in his hands and started singing and praying and, you know, yelling, saying, you know, Lord, you've got to take the burden of the cells from this woman. She can't take it anymore. It's going to kill her. And, you know, and I was sitting there in a chair nearby scribbling notes. I'd never seen anything like this in my life. You know, I was raised in a family that was not particularly religious. This was just nothing unlike my world at all. And I was sitting there scribbling notes and trying to keep track of everything that was going on. And, you know, and he said, Lord, you got to take the burden of these cells. And then he just turned to me and put his hands on either side of my head and said, you've got to give them to her. And you know, his hands are shaking on either side of my head. And, you know, he essentially transferred the cells from Deborah into me, which was another pivotal moment. That was really, in a sense, I'd been resisting being a character in the book at all. And it was that moment later that I sort of realized, okay, I have no choice but to sort of be in there.
How was Deborah after this strange ritual?
She was amazingly relieved. Yeah, there was absolutely a sense of a burden being lifted for her, and also a transference to me in some senses that, you know, I think part of what was going on is that her cousin really, you know, she was wanting very badly for, you know, me to be able to tell the story, and I think there was some element of, you know, him saying, you've got to let her do this. You know, you can't take the burden of all this on yourself. And, you know, it is going to kill you, and you've got to, like, sort of let go of some of this. And she did. It really gave me an entirely new appreciation for the power that faith plays, the power that faith has and the role that it plays in people's lives. You know, it was the first thing that had really ever happened to her that let her just absolutely relax and say, okay, this is okay. Like, you know, I'm going to let this go and try to move on with my life and become okay with the cells before they kill me, basically.
Biotech companies have made millions or billions from the sale of the cells of Henrietta Lacks, the HeLa cells, and it saved millions of lives. Deborah's no longer with us. She died not so long ago, as you write in your book. How are the Lacks family doing health-wise? What kind of help do they get? Or have they had, not, I should say, up until now?
Yeah, not much has changed for them. I mean, one of the moments in the story in the 70s when the family first found out about the cells, not long after that, they found out that these cells were being bought and sold. And, you know, now you can, anyone can go online and buy a vial of them for about $200, or you can buy products made using them for up to about $10,000 a vial. To this day, her family can't afford health insurance. They sort of live on and sometimes with it, sometimes without it. They struggle, absolutely. Her sons are in their 60s and 70s now, and they have high blood pressure and diabetes and, you know, sort of diseases of inner city impoverished African Americans. And they haven't gotten a lot of help. One of the things when I began working on the book, I started learning about what happened to the family, I realized that I was essentially in a position to be another person who came along and potentially benefited from these cells in some way without the family getting anything out of it. So I set up a foundation. It's called the Henry Lacks Foundation, and some of the proceeds of the book go in there, and it's open for anyone to donate to. There's a website, henrylacksfoundation.org. My initial hope with it was as a scholarship fund to be able to help descendants of Henry Lacks get an education. And I'm hoping that it will become big enough so that other people in need will be able to use it as well. I hope it will help her kids with health insurance and various other things. And actually yesterday, for the first time, the foundation board, which is me and two other people, met. And based on the funds that have gone in there since the book came out, we were able to give scholarships to five descendants of Henry Lacks who are going to be going to school starting in the fall. And we were also able to help one of her sons, Sonny Lacks, who he's a truck driver, and his truck broke down recently, and he's been unable to work because he hasn't been able to come up with the money to fix his truck. So he was able to apply for an emergency grant to get his truck fixed. And so now he's back out on the road. And right now, you know, so far, the donations have been just from general readers and from the book. I've been hoping that there will be, you know, companies out there, biotech companies, who will feel like they can donate to the foundation. That hasn't happened yet.
Yes. Someone needs to go and prod them with a stick, I think, Rebecca. This is an extraordinary story. Just finally, my final question to you is, like you say, you were such a different background from Deborah Lacks, the daughter of Henrietta. You couldn't be more different as human beings. How are you different now, Rebecca, after this process?
Oh, I think I'll be figuring that out for a few years still, and maybe the rest of my life. I was exposed to so much through this process that I had just never experienced in my life, you know, the combination of the different cultures that we came from and really the religious differences, you know, and I think in some ways that's one of the things that was very impactful for me was, you know, I read the Bible for the first time. I went to churches and faith healings and I really began to understand religion in a different way. Often people, you know, especially Christians who read the book, say, so did they convert you? Have you been saved? And the answer is no. I have exactly the same beliefs that I did going in, but I have a very different appreciation for a lot of different religions that I didn't really have before. And the importance, you know, people often talk about the conflict between science and religion and the fact that these two things are always at odds. And through the Lacks story, one of the things that I really came to believe is that, in fact, they aren't, and that religion and faith can actually help people understand science if they're sort of given the chance.
Rebecca, this is such an amazing story, and I think your book is extraordinary and a kindness as well, as I said. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being my guest in Conversation.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web. You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.